Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and we're delighted to have you with us today. And I have my good buddy Robin Martinez with me. Hi, Robin.
Hi, Joyce. Lovely to be here as always.
Great. So Robin's in Colorado and I'm in Massachusetts and we have some very special guests with us today that I want to introduce to you. You probably noticed the title of the show is Why One-Third of Hospitals Will Close by 2020. Interesting, but
you're probably
wondering why that would be true, and that's what we want to talk about today. We're at a time when there's a very big shift going on in the world of healthcare, and it's sometimes called a disruptive time, or as one of our guests will tell you, it's called the shift age. We're moving from one paradigm in healthcare to an entirely different paradigm. And it doesn't mean you're not going to get healthcare. It's just that it's going to be delivered in some different ways. And I just went to a very exciting conference sponsored by Partners in Boston that showed me that the hospitals are really working on this. Maybe not all of them, but some of them have very much undertaken to work with this shift in the technology and the delivery system to make it wonderful and much better for you. So let me bring on our guests here. We have David Houle, who is a futurist, a thinker, and a speaker, and he's even been nominated for an Academy Award. So he's written several books about the shift age in education as well as in healthcare. So welcome, David.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. And we also have Jonathan Fleece, his co-author on a book about the shift in healthcare. And Jonathan is an attorney, an advisor, and a speaker located in Tampa, Florida. So welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you, Joyce and Robin. Pleasure to be on the show.
Great. So first of all, tell us, what is one of these disruptive events? Why do these things happen in various markets from time to time, like Amazon.com changing the world for small bookstores?
Well, that's a very good question. I travel the world talking about the future, and I coined the phrase shift age, left the information age, entered the shift age. And this is an age where everything shifts. Most of human thought and institutions change as we've experienced. So within that context, if you look at healthcare, which, as you know, is about 17.1% of the GDP this year, all of that connectivity and transparency and electronic records and everything that we demand and expect when we do banking, when we can do shopping, is now just coming to healthcare. Healthcare is the only part of the GDP which is yet to convert to the shift age. So as Jonathan and I wrote in our book, when we wrote it almost 4 years ago, came out in early 2012, we said that connectivity, price competition, and transparency would be things that would have to come to the health sector. So I give speeches all over the world at healthcare conferences, and I put up a slide that basically was from 2012. An internist at the University of Iowa called 100 United States hospitals and asked them a single sentence question: how much does it cost to have hip replacement surgery in your hospital? Of the 100 that he asked, 50 could not answer the question. And of the 50 that did, the price range was from $11,000 to $123,000. So, I just say to an audience, would you go in and have your car worked down without getting a price estimate and a warranty on the work? Of course you wouldn't. So why are you going to give your body to somebody who says, I don't know how much it's going to cost and there's no warranty on the work that we do? So basically, an oversimplified way to answer your question is that price competition, searchability, and quality is now going to be comparable online. That's why Amazon succeeded, because they have better customer service and it's cheaper and you don't have to do anything and it comes to your house. So now you can go online if you have to have a hip replacement surgery, and any hospital that doesn't have an open database telling you how much it costs and everything, you won't look at. So So it's going to bring price competition to the marketplace. That's the disrupting event, is technological price competition.
Right. So what you put four items in your article 3 years ago talking about why this is going to happen. And first, we talked about that America really is compelled now to deal with healthcare costs because they've really gotten to the point where they're crippling the budget. And you mentioned that it's now, what, almost 20% of the gross product in this country?
It's 17.1%, down from 17.3%. So Obamacare and what we can talk about are driving costs down already. So, but it's 17%, you know, which Jonathan can speak about. You know, the global competition of the United States is a total risk. Our whole economy is a total risk because of this.
And
yeah, I mean, if you look
those,
at – go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you look at the raw data, the U.S. spends on average about $9,000 per person on health care costs, and that's amongst the highest per person on health care of any industrialized nation in the world. And then the more telling question to that as well is, well, what is the return on investment for that? And then that's where you really look at, well, how does the U.S. rank on healthcare outcomes and quality? And we are definitely not in the top tier. So we're spending in the top tier, but the outcomes certainly don't put us in the top tier from a quality or outcomes perspective.
So I've heard things like we spend at least twice as much as the next nearest country.
Right.
Per person. And we're ranked something like 17th in quality of health care.
That's
right. And you can, you know, have statisticians and the data analysts sort of bop heads and debate some of those percentage points. But, yes, the general consensus of what you just said is accurate. And sort of the other layer of that onion is that it depends on which socioeconomic class you fall in as to the quality of health care that you receive in this country. So if you have a job and receive health insurance benefits through an employer or are on Medicare over the age of 65, your health care is probably way higher on that list comparatively. But if you're unemployed, underemployed, part-time employed, Medicaid, you now start to drop dramatically almost into a third-world healthcare type system, which eventually catches up to the rest of us, because what happens to that population group? They don't get preventative care. They don't get proactive care. They show up in the emergency room when there's a chronic condition or an acute episode, drives up the cost that then simply gets pushed to the taxpayers and corporate America.
Right. And
right. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to add to that when you don't have open, compassionate health care for everyone, then those that can afford to pay subsidize those that can't. And that's the reason to try to get everybody health care coverage. And we think it ultimately may well go to a single-payer system, at least I do, because it's where it is everywhere else in the world. And the statistics are just mind-boggling. Now that the government is publishing the costs of procedures in hospitals, there's no rhyme or reason that Jonathan, I think you sent me an article last week about New Jersey, where it was like $7,000 to $93,000 for a knee replacement or something.
Right. The disparaging cost, is, even within one metropolitan area, is striking.
And so one of the reasons that hospitals are going to go out of business is they've never had to compete on price and quality. So any business that's never had to deal with competitive reality tends to overcharge and tends to be lax, which leads to the second point that you put up on your blog is, we have statistics from 2010 in our book. In 2010, 34,000 people died in the United States due to accidents in cars and on highways. 100,000 people in the United States died due to accidents in hospitals. And then we took the amount of admissions, which was, I think, 37 million hospital admissions in 2010, and you do the math, which means that one out of every 267 people admitted to a hospital dies in the hospital due to a mistake made by the hospital. So statistically, as of 2010, it was the most dangerous place for an American to be in the United States, more than a coal mine, more than a plane, more than in traffic. So that's one of the things. So they're very inefficient and they're very dangerous. So bringing the cost down, if it was, say, $40,000 for an open heart surgery, and then they got an infection that the hospital said, oh, it's another $100,000, the hospital could pass along those costs. Now they won't be able to. So if they don't get efficient, they'll go out of business. So some of them are just going to go out of business because they can't meet that standard of functionality, efficiency, and price competition.
Yes, one of the things
Go ahead, Brian. Do you think some of the problem with pricing efficiency has been all hospitals trying to be all things to all people, so that a small hospital can do open heart surgery, but it's not really cost efficient because they do so few?
Go ahead, Jonathan.
I actually do think that is part of the driver. And if you look at the 20th century model for reimbursing hospitals, in the end, the government payers would essentially look at what's called a cost report, and the government would end up basically covering, and this is sort of an oversimplified answer, but they would essentially cover a hospital's overhead on that cost report with no market pressure pushing against it to bring it within a fair market value. So I think your example is very apropos. You could be in a small community, 300,000 people, and have a hospital decide they wanted to open up a heart program, an orthopedic program, a cancer program, drive those costs up without really having enough volume to function in the way the other free market would to justify some of those costs, and then the government and the insurance payers would simply have to pick up that expense.
So relative to the one third of the hospitals going out of business, so that really is impacting, is it not, Jonathan, the rural hospitals, per our experience? Rural hospitals, like there's one a week closing because they cannot afford to provide the scope at the scale needed.
Absolutely, yeah. David's statistics are accurate. We have right now about one a week rural hospitals closing, and the National Rural Health Association has identified roughly another 250 that are in danger. That's just right now. It's about 10% of the total. So we are on track to really have a substantial consolidation through closure and reallocations in the rural hospital and inner city hospitals as well.
Do you see any role for telemedicine in helping these smaller rural hospitals get up to speed without having so much expense?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead, David, then I'll give a few examples.
Yeah, very simply, there's this whole thing about big data. So the example I give when I give speeches is you're sick, and what do you normally do? You crawl out of bed. You don't know if you're infectious. You call the doctor. Please, can you have her see me? So you have to get dressed, drive in, sit there, and get a prescription and then go home. With telemedicine, with a database, for example, you'll dial into the doctor's office. You won't even speak to the doctor, but just some compassionate healthcare professional saying, so what are your symptoms? Oh, hold on a minute. And she turns around, she types it into the database and comes back and says, well, there were 137,000 people last year that had the symptoms that you had. Two-thirds of them were successfully treated with this medicine. Are you allergic to it? No. Okay, well, I've already ordered it to your pharmacy and it'll be delivered to you. So in that case, you didn't have any of the cost of getting there. You didn't have the cost of potentially infecting somebody else. You didn't have the cost of the doctor. You just had telehealth. Absolutely. So the more remote you are, the more important telehealth is going to be.
Right, absolutely. When we research the book, and we cite this in the New Health Age book, University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, back in the 2010 era when we were doing the research, had already deployed a basically acute care episode or a trauma care episode telemedicine program throughout its network in western Pennsylvania, where the trauma center, the quaternary tertiary center, was focused in Pittsburgh, but they had a network throughout the western part of Pennsylvania into the rural areas, where if patients had strokes, heart attacks, you know, an immediate episode, they could then dial in through telemedicine, link them straight into Pittsburgh, where you would have the neurosurgeons or the cardiac surgeons and really walk the local team through what they needed to do. So I think that's going to be the new model for rural hospitals that are able to survive during this shakeout. David and I were advising a rural hospital through their strategic planning process a month or so ago in rural South Carolina. They've deployed a similar model where they connect into a quaternary tertiary hospital facility in a major city. And then for the more proactive, preventative type care that for hospitals that are close to a metropolitan area, I think a lot of that's going to become more like a glorified urgent care model in the rural communities. And then some of the other surgical procedures that can be planned and aren't of in a crisis state, I think you'll start seeing those move to the metropolitan hospitals.
So you keep using these numbers to rate different levels of care, different levels of expertise, and I'm wondering, what are the current levels and what levels do you see coming?
You know, on the rating system, clarify the question a little bit, if you would.
Well, you say quaternary, tertiary.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think most of our listeners will understand that. So what kind of center are you talking about here?
And
you see others depending on them.
Sure. So a quaternary tertiary is a academic medical center type environment, typically where you've got a trauma center, a medical school, teaching facility, lots of research going on that's generally in the larger cities. So I think a lot of your super specialized, cutting-edge healthcare that's not in an emergency situation or a day-to-day preventative primary care situation, a lot of that type of care is going to go into these, we'll call them academic medical center type environments. And then I think the next tier down will be more of your community hospitals, suburban type hospitals, where you'll have, you know, OB and birthing centers and women's centers and men's centers and things like that. And then when you go down to the sub tier, you'll be into the rural communities that, as I said earlier, I think are generally going to become hospitals will become more urgent care oriented, and then have a primary care focus outside of the hospital to try to focus on managing chronic disease, keeping diabetes under control, preventing diabetes, same with heart disease and other conditions.
So it's kind of an escalation scheme where you start with your primary care doctor. The secondary would be if you need to go to the hospital, you're probably going to a local hospital. But if you have something specialized, a rare disease or kidney cancer or, you know, something that takes higher skill, then you go to a tertiary center, the third one up the chain, and they presumably have all the specialists and know better how to deal with it. And then the quad one would be a level above that. But we're moving to a different paradigm, as I understand it. So instead of starting with your primary care doctor, you're probably starting with one of these Doctor on Demand or American Well are two of the bigger dial-up services where you can have a chat, a video chat with the doctor and do something like David described before, where you get, based on experience, the probability is that this medication is going to help you. So let's try that and we'll see. And you didn't leave the house. So we're getting almost house calls again. Virtual house calls, if you will, to start with, and then move up the chain as we need to. But many of these call-up centers are partnering with, as they say, brick-and-mortar hospitals because there is a time and a place when you are going to need that kind of specialized care. Those tertiary centers are still going to have a need for that. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, but I want to. Have you ever heard of Dr. Devi Shetty?
No.
Okay, Dr. Devi Shetty. That's Shetty. Is easily the most transformative healthcare professional on the planet. And we cited him in our book, The New Health Age, Future of Healthcare in America. And we put him in the category of medical tourism because he was doing open-heart surgeries for anybody, whether they could pay or not, in Bangalore, India, for $1,900. And at the time, the Cleveland Clinic was charging $50,000. And yet Dr. Shetty had a better outcome than the Cleveland Clinic. So we were making the point that you could fly to India, stay in a 5-star hotel, bring your spouse along, have the surgery, recover, and come back for the price of just the procedure, let alone the anesthetic and everything else in the Cleveland Clinic. So when Dr. Shetty, his first call to fame was he was asked to make a house call. It was Mother Teresa. So he was Mother Teresa's doctor. And he got together with a couple of investment banks to build up. He has like 4,000 hospital beds. He's been called the Henry Ford of medicine by Forbes and the Wall Street Journal. He's done over 18,000 surgeries. He's lost count. His surgeons do 5 or 6 heart surgeries a day, which is about how much a doctor in America does on a busy week. So he's brought scale to a craft business. So surgery is a craft business, right? And anytime you bring scale to a craft business, you can lower prices. So he realized he couldn't do it without, you know, invading the United States. So I was fortunate to speak at the opening of the health city Cayman Islands, which opened in February of 2014. And so 1 hour from Miami, you can get world-class health care for a fraction of the cost that you can in Miami or anywhere in the United States. And I just spoke with them. They sent me some information. They're putting all the prices online. Walmart is coming down to see if they can be used. They're already the official hospital of the Caribbean for the Royal Caribbean. The major healthcare companies are coming down, insurance companies, because they need to save costs. So here you have a guy who basically says there is no healthcare reform if it's not compassionate, and that that only 8% of the people alive on the planet could have treatment for a heart disease should they have one, and that's just not right. So he's coming from a Mother Teresa point of view, and he has built this hospital at a third the cost with about a third of the expenses and payments. And so that's the future of the hospital. High efficiency. I'll give you an example. You were talking about telehealth. So I was at this hospital right when it opened, and there's this big screen, a huge flat screen TV, like the biggest one you could possibly have in your house. And it was live, and it was 12 noon in Grand Cayman Island. And I said, at this point in time, we're first name basis. I said, Devi, what's that? And he said, that's the hospital in Bangalore at midnight, because all our data shows that when there's a shift change in a hospital, that's when mistakes and accidents can occur. So we can monitor live from Grand Cayman the shift change in the intensive care unit at Bangalore, which is 12 hours ahead, and vice versa. So in Bangalore, when we have a shift change here. So I was sitting there on Grand Cayman Island looking at a completely full intensive care unit in Bangalore as the shift change was going on. So, and then they go down to a operating room, and there's a big picture window with tropical plants outside. Now, imagine any operating room you've ever been in. It's all metallic. It's fluorescent. It's very, industrial. And there's this big picture window. And I said, Devi, why do you have that? He says, well, after all our research shows that after a surgeon has done 2 or 3 procedures, their creativity goes down. So we give them a break, and they go get some natural light, look out to a pretty landscape, and it increases their creativity. So a completely rethought hospital model using technology, scale, low cost, and competitive pricing is the model of the future. So that hospital is the hospital of the future. Jonathan and I are going down there early next year because we're going to write a follow-up book, and they're going to, spend a couple of days with us, because that is the hospital of the future, no question about it.
That's great. So let me ask you this. the two things that patients want to know when they're choosing a hospital is the cost, but also the quality. How do we find which doctor, in fact, has more good outcomes than another doctor? Right now, that's almost impossible to find. So are there ways to actually do that kind of comparison?
Of course, shopping? Of course. Well, I mean, we found in our research, and Jonathan, you may remember the specifics more than I do, the mortality rate at Shetty's Hospital in Bangalore for open heart surgery was 1.7, and the Cleveland Clinic was 1.9, meaning there's a higher percentage of people dying after procedures at the Cleveland Clinic. So there's all kinds of ways you can measure it. It's just that they haven't revealed it. Right.
Right. And I to also give you sort of a sense of where it's coming to the consumer today. The data exists. It's just to your point, it hasn't been transparent and is readily available like you would have in a consumer reports kind of environment. But because of disintermediation and power to the individual and some of the concepts that David talks about in some of his other books, there are companies out there that are exposing the quality data. Health grades is one example. There's some other internet sources where you can go and get access to quality data. But over the next 5 years, that data will become more and more reliable. Right now, I will say that it's not as reliable on a internet by internet site basis, but it will all become transparent, and you can basically look at star rankings and other type of quality rankings by hospital, by physician, by surgery center, physician group, et cetera.
Right. I mean, that's one of the things when I see these ads, voted the number one hospital, my first thought is on what metrics and by whom, right? Was it just a rotational, this year you're going to get it, next year, Joe, you'll get it? Or was it based on price-quality metrics? Because that's what the rest of the economy is based upon.
Right. And I remember once when I was in London, I actually took a picture of an ad on the street for an MRI for £400. Blew my mind, because in Boston, it's somewhere between $1,000 and $10,000, depending who is doing it at what hospital.
Right.
We're down to the last 3 minutes, and I wanted to give Robin a chance because she had a question.
Actually, I wanted to know, how do you keep people in the ICU under care during the shift change? Because typically what happens is all the staff gather, the outgoing staff, the incoming staff, and the outgoing people update the incoming people, but nobody's with the patients.
So what Shetty does in his hospital is he has one big room, okay? And there's three things that he's doing differently than any other intensive care unit I've seen. Number one, every bed has a window. And there's research that shows that healing and getting dismissed, discharged from a hospital is more rapid if you have an outside view, if you have natural light. The second thing is there's one big room. So it's a row of beds, if you can imagine, you know, about 20 yards long, beds on one side, beds on the other. So one person can see all the monitors. So one person can always be monitoring while the rest of the staff is talking. And the third thing is that every patient that gets checked in for surgery, whether it's orthopedic or heart surgery, is given a tablet. And that tablet stays with the patient from the time they're checked in to the time they're discharged. And every single healthcare interface is noted on that tablet. So there's a consistency, and all of that information goes to a central technological hub in the hospital that's always being monitored. So every tablet's being monitored, and every tablet has a record of every health interchange that occurs from the time the patient is admitted to the time they're dismissed.
Wow. That sounds
Really
efficient.
Right. And the tablets cost them like $75.
Sure, because the price is coming way down. And so it's a combination of technology and some very creative thinking of, if I were going to start with a white sheet of paper and design the new process based on today's possibilities, today's methodologies and technologies and so forth. How would I design this? And as you're describing, it sounds like that's what Dr. Shetty has done. It's like totally redesign the system. And
right.
Too many of the hospitals are doing it just because they always did it that way.
Thank you very much to Jonathan Fleece and David Houle for being with us today. And there's information about their many books on the webpage that goes with this show. And thank you so much to Robin, of course, for being here, and to everyone for joining us today. So we hope you will be with us again next week. And meanwhile, be well and be a powerful patient. Take good care.